Hey, good morning, everybody. I just turned my recorder on right here. So I do record lectures, right, in case you want to listen to these lectures once again. Okay, so what class is this? What happened to my microphone? I thought it was working. I had it working. What color is that light? That's not a good color. Okay. All right, we're going to get started in just a second. Batteries crashed. Okay, we're switching the batteries out. Reboot the transmitter. This is looking good. Green light. All right, so test. Yeah, good morning, everybody. And welcome to class. And let's figure out what class this is. I'm projecting the syllabus, and I'm here for Bio 241, Human Physiology. Anybody else here for that class? Not too many, a few. Yeah, you are. Good. Okay, it sounds like we're in the right place then. That's great. All right, so I'm Dr. Gober. I'm going to be teaching this class, not the labs, but the lectures. This is a hybrid class, so there's a lot of online instruction. There's some online testing, so you have to be familiar with the internet. So you have me as an instructor, and you also have another instructor in this class, which is helpful. You have an SI, Supplemental Instruction Instructor, right? Janice Cho, who is right here, and she wants to say hi and tell you something about supplemental instruction.
Hi, guys. My name is Janice, and I will be the SI leader for this course. How many of you guys have heard about SI? Okay, good. How many of you guys have attended an SI session? Wow, okay, great. For those of you guys who are not familiar with the SI program, it's called Supplemental Instruction. It's a free and voluntary program that's offered by Cypress College for the general physio is tough, but it's doable, and I know because I've been there. I took both anatomy and physiology with Dr. Gober and was an SI leader for the same course last semester. And my goal for you guys is to just provide a time and place for you guys to come to study with your peers, review lecture material for prior to the lecture, and then prepare for exams. So even if you're doing well in class, you have an A and you want to keep that A, come stop by, study, review material, and we'll have fun. My sessions will start next week, not this week, and it'll be on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Tuesdays and Thursdays right before lecture. The time right now is 9:30 to 11. It might change a little bit, but it'll probably be around that time prior to lecture. And location will be determined soon. And my email address is up there, so if you have any questions, feel free to contact me. But does anybody have any questions at this moment?
How does SI help you?
How does SI help
you? Yeah, is there any data that shows that it is beneficial to students?
Statistics show that if you do attend SI regularly, like on a regular basis, it can bump up your grade by a half to a full letter grade higher. So that's something in mind. We all want to achieve that goal, get the higher grade that you want, so SI can help you achieve that.
Okay, I got another question.
Yes.
Okay, so in lab you go there and you do experiments and you break glassware and stuff like that. You actually do stuff. In lecture you kind of sit and listen, but maybe we'll do some interactive stuff, but maybe not too much. What kind of learning style does supplemental instruction offer? Is it just a lecture or is it a lab or what?
We kind of focus more on group activity and facilitation, so it's not going to be me standing lecturing you guys, kind of like what you guys have here, but it's going to be you guys taking the material and engaging yourselves and working with your fellow peers. And that kind of emphasizes and makes you remember the material even better. So that's something that we try to incorporate.
That's good, yeah. So interactive exercises, yeah. More group work, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you can learn sometimes by sitting and listening to somebody talk, but probably what's even better is when you actually talk to somebody about the information that you're trying to learn. You just activate so many different areas of your brain, and your recall and knowledge is much better when that happens, and SI allows you to do that. Yeah. Nice. Thank you for coming. Excellent. I won't take time to show you when we get into Blackboard, but there is a button in the left-hand frame that says Supplemental Instruction, and that contains the contact information for your SI leader. Okay. All right, so this class is kind of interesting because you do have three instructors for this class. You've got the computer, which everybody loves, right? You got me, and you have Janice. So take advantage of that. Everybody learns in a little bit different manner. As we were saying, sometimes people learn a lot by listening. That's how I learn. Some people learn a lot by reading something. Some people learn a lot by writing something. So if you want to rewrite your notes after class, that might be what's good for you. And that's why maybe listening to the lecture once again to fill in pieces of a lecture that you've missed. Other ways that people learn, some people have very good graphic memories. They can look at illustrations and understand pictures very, very well. And that's kind of the class that you have graduated from. That's anatomy. Anatomy is very visual. Physiology is not as visual, but I try to employ some techniques to help you visualize what's going on, and that's what the study guide is all about. You saw a lot of figures in the study guide that comes with your textbook, and that's just my attempt to introduce some visual learning into a physiology class. What else do people do? Oh, sometimes people learn by actually moving. In anatomy, that's helpful because you can move your body and figure out what bones are moving, muscles and things like that. Physiology, I don't know. We think, well, we'll try. Okay, maybe breathing, heart rate, stuff like that. In lab, you'll do those kinds of things. All right, so here is your class. There's three sections in here. So there's going to be a lab this afternoon at 1 o'clock. And then on Thursday, there's going to be a lab at 1 and then another one at 4:30. If you are enrolled in either of these labs, then you have to be there right at the beginning of lab because, you know, this class is impacted. Not everybody has registered for this class. And if there's a no-show, then I drop people immediately at the beginning of lab and give add codes to people that are on the wait list or petitioners. All right, so if you don't show up right at lab, I don't know if you're serious about the class or not, right? So make sure that you're right there. Even if the instructor is late, just hang out. That's good. Okay, so hybrid class means that you have to have internet access. I use a PC. I've got a PC here, but when I look around the room, I see Mac. Oh, maybe a Mac here. Is that a Mac? Yes, a lot of Mac machines. And I think Macintosh works just fine as long as you are running Firefox. Can you run Firefox on that? No? What can you run on your machine right there? Okay, yeah, see how that works. I know most people use Firefox and PC, you can use Firefox or Internet Explorer. Sometimes there's problems with Internet Explorer when there's an upgrade. Sometimes there's problems with Firefox when they upgrade something, so you just have to pay attention, right? The browsers are not static, but they change pretty frequently with different kinds of updates. And Blackboard changes throughout the semester, too. So you just have to be nimble when you're using a computer. One thing that has never worked for me so far is a true mobile device, like that, and a cell phone. I can get into Blackboard and I can work some of the interactive exercises and get to the study guide, but when it comes to taking a quiz, that's where it fails. Right? So you can take a quiz, it will allow you to take a quiz, and it looks like you've completed a quiz, but it loses the handshake and it doesn't transfer the information, your score, into Blackboard. And it doesn't even give me any information that you've logged into Blackboard. So you've got to be careful about that with mobile devices. So maybe that has changed because things change very rapidly. All right, so how do you get into this class? Probably there are some people that need to register. Go ahead, raise your hand if you need to register still. Okay? Not too many. Oh, we got a good chance of getting you in the class. All right, this is how you get into the class. I don't give ad codes in lecture because I still see a bunch of seats that are open, and I don't know if we're filled or overfilled just by looking at lecture. Where I understand where that is happening is in lab, right, where we can only have about 25 students in lab. That's the number of computers we have and other kinds of chemicals and things like that. So that's where I will give ad codes out. So if you want to add the class, go to the very opening second of that lab, and as I said, I will see who's there and replace no-shows and give out ad codes at that particular time. So you got to go to lab, and maybe you have to go to all of them. I'm not really sure. Okay, you certainly go to the one today. If you don't get in today, then either of the two on Thursday, right? Okay, people that were on the wait list didn't get all the material that I emailed everybody, and they didn't have access to Blackboard, but when you get an ad code, register right away, and then 24 hours after that, you'll have access to Blackboard, and I'll give you information on how to access Blackboard. All right, so what else do we want to know about this particular class? Here is something new. I don't know if it's improved. It might be improved. This is the new URL for Blackboard. Cypress College used to host Blackboard on a server over at the district office, and for some reason they decided to go back with Blackboard as their service, and so the URL had to change. And it is cypresscollege.blackboard.com. So please don't use a bookmark from last semester if you were taking an online class or hybrid class with someone else. That link won't take you to the right spot. All right, so this is it right here. Maybe you have an electronic copy of this. You can go ahead and bookmark this URL if you want to. All right, the required materials is this loose leaf edition of your textbook, and then the spiral bound edition of the lab book. They're two separate textbooks. Included in this loose leaf binder, or the loose leaf edition of the textbook, which is the 12th edition of Fox. There's Fox, and it's the 12th edition that we're going to be using. There is the study guide that's printed out for you, right, so you can practice labeling pictures, right? Don't lose your illustration skills or your graphic memory skills. Practice that before a test. And it also includes an access code for Connect. Question. Oh, okay, like drjgober.com? Oh, that one. Yeah, I got to update that. That's right. This is the current one. Yeah, this is the current edition. It's the 12th edition, and this is specially customized for Cypress College. Any 12th edition will work. Okay, but if you buy a 12th edition from somewhere else, it won't have the study guide, and you would probably want to print that out. So it's actually a little bit cheaper to just buy it all together. The Connect, the access code to Connect was just thrown in with this custom package. You're not paying for that when you buy this package, but it does give you some ability to look at this textbook online. It gives you the e-textbook as well. So this publisher, McGraw-Hill, is just trying to introduce that concept to all the students. So that comes along with it. But I do have a comment with regard to that. The current textbook that McGraw-Hill publishes is the 13th edition, right? And we're using the 12th because I don't like to change editions because it's really expensive for everybody, for students and instructors. And I've tried to pair up this 12th edition with your Blackboard course, and it won't let me. It will only allow me to pair up the 13th edition. So I'm working with the publisher to make sure that I can get the correct electronic version of the textbook to you, which is the 12th edition. Okay, any questions on that? Once you work with it a little bit, it will sort of make sense. All right, what are some other things that you need? Well, you need a pencil, some Scantrons, and probably more importantly, a really good eraser for your tests. Make sure when you come take a test, take your pencil, make a mark on a nice clean piece of paper, then your eraser, and erase it. And if it smudges that line, just throw your eraser away and buy one that I have referenced in the syllabus right here, right? Because there just can't be any smudges on a Scantron. I'm sure you all know how to fill out a Scantron. Some of us get a little sloppy sometimes, and if you're sloppy on a board exam, you might not pass it, even though you know all the information. And does anybody know how much a board exam costs these days? It's hundreds of dollars. Yeah, it's at least $500. So you'd hate to have to pay another $500 to take the test over again, even though you passed it the first time, but the machine couldn't read your answers, right? So protect yourself that way. As far as grading goes, what are you going to be graded on? Not attendance, but you'll be graded on quizzes and lecture exams, and maybe some other kind of assignments online. But there are online quizzes. There are lab quizzes. You'll have a lab quiz every week, and then you're going to have four tests in here during the semester. So, and then the grade scale is just a strict 90, 80, 70, 60, and maybe a couple hundreds in there, okay? 100, 90, 80, 70, 60 for A, B, C, D. So you can see the grade distribution for all the different aspects of the class, like lab quizzes, online quizzes. One thing that you might notice that's in bold print over here, makeups, that's real tough to do in this class. All right, so just plan on no makeups unless you can talk to me way ahead of time and convince me that, you definitely need a makeup for some reason. All right, the online quizzes, like I said, you have to take one every week. And as you're looking at the pages in Blackboard, there's going to be a lot of pages. Some of the pages are very interesting interactive exercises or tutorial, but not all the pages will earn you course points. So you definitely want to pay attention to course point pages. And so what I've included on every page that you have to accomplish for course points, I put this little symbol right here, right? The United States dollar sign. So if you're mousing around in Blackboard, and this dollar sign, this gold dollar sign catches your eye, guess what? That's what you want to accomplish for course points. And then, of course, that's how you get points for your particular grade. Don't ever miss a lab quiz or an online quiz because it's hard to average zeros out. If you get a bad grade, you can always average it back up, but a zero is really hard to do. And that's especially true with a lecture exam. If you have a zero on one lecture exam, there's just no way to pass the class. So pay attention to the schedule. When you're online, pay attention to these dollar signs, and then you'll earn all of the points available to you, especially these online points, because an online quiz, you can take an unlimited number of times before the deadline, but how many times after the deadline? Zero times after the deadline. All right, so that just helps you gain some skill in time management and meeting deadlines. And these quizzes aren't very difficult. And since you can take them an unlimited number of times, what kind of score should everybody have for each one of these quizzes? Yeah, perfect. That's exactly right, because you can go back in and take it. Okay, and there is really no reason why you will miss a quiz if you follow one simple technique. So there's a way to guarantee that you'll never miss a quiz, an online quiz. Right? Well, when are they due? Let me tell you when they're due. They're going to be due every Thursday at 11 p.m., except for this week because it's a short week. Thursday at 11 p.m., just ingrain that day and time into your memory. Maybe get a crayon and write it on the mirror in your bathroom or something, right, until you're absolutely familiar with that day and that time. But the way that you never miss a deadline is just stay 1 week ahead, so that if something strange happens and your attention is disrupted and you forget to go to Blackboard on a Thursday by 11 p.m. and submit a quiz, it won't kill you because why? The quiz is already done, right? So just stay 1 week ahead and that won't ever happen to you. Okay, so there is the grading scale. And I think that's pretty much all I want to say about the syllabus. You can read through it. Here is the lecture exam schedule. And then after that, here is the lab schedule. And we don't have a Monday lab, which is good because they miss out on a lot of labs, which is too bad because I think you'll enjoy the labs. All right, any questions on the syllabus? Yeah. Okay, I made Blackboard for the first weeks up until the first test. I don't know if that's 5 weeks. Yeah, the first 4 weeks, all right, I made available. And so those first four quizzes are available. Plus, there is an extra credit quiz that's available right now that's going to go away. It's that syllabus quiz. So you should go ahead and get that syllabus quiz done and start working on the other quizzes and just get a week ahead of schedule. That would be really nice. All right. So this quiz that's going to be due on week four, right, you could probably go in and take that 100 times before week four comes around. And the way that I have it set up, at least I've intended to have it set up this way, if you get 100% on a quiz, but you want to go back in and review that quiz one more time, but you're concerned that you're going to perform less, you might get 50% when you go back in, that your grade is going to decrease as a result of that. But I programmed Blackboard to always store your highest grade. So if you take a quiz, get 100%, go back in, and then get a 25, go back in, get a 75, it's going to store the 100% for you. So don't let that inhibit you from going and taking those quizzes once again. But they are going to disappear on the deadline. That's all there's to it. Okay, another question.
If we're waitlisted for Thursday night,
yeah.
Do we show up to today's live as well?
You know, I would, because the number of ad codes I give out will depend on no-shows. And there's no way to know no-shows, where they will be. Maybe there will be a lot of no-shows today, and then I'll fill up the lab for today. On Thursday, there might not be any no-shows, so I won't be able to give out any ad codes. So you would miss an opportunity to join the class as long as you could take the lab on a Tuesday. So I would, as long as you can get into this class one way or the other, I would just do it, all right, even if it is today, as long as your schedule permits that, okay? Your best chances are in the class that you are on the wait list for, because I go through the wait list first to add students. So if you're on the wait list for Thursday, that's your best chance of getting in. But there's an outside chance you could get in on a Tuesday. Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. Okay. Anything else regarding the syllabus, things like that? There's probably some things that I forgot that I'll try to mention next week, this week, sometime like that. All right, so here is the internet. I usually use Firefox. I know other instructors that are much more comfortable using Internet Explorer. Chrome, sometimes I have heard, is a little bit problematic, but you just have to pay attention to what you're doing when it comes time for submitting a quiz. All right, so here's Blackboard. Remember, this is a new URL. This is a new site. It's different than the one you were using last time. And this week, today and on Thursday, this is the first thing, the most important thing that we want to accomplish in this class. That if you're registered, you have to be able to get into Blackboard to start doing some of the activities in Blackboard. So if you're trying to get into Blackboard and you can't get in, then we have to solve that this week because you can't get behind in the class. So who's registered in here and has tried to get into Blackboard but cannot get in for some reason? Raise your hand if you cannot get in. Oh, but you're not registered yet. Oh, okay. You can talk to your instructor, but make sure you're using the URL that I've shown you right here. All right, it's really confusing. Well, that's good. If for some reason you can't get in, make sure you talk to me or your lab instructor to make sure that happens. All right, so this is how you log in, right? Here's your student ID number. Just some random number. And down over here, you got to put your password in. Usually your password from my gateway works, but they're two separate programs. They have to handshake and communicate information. Sometimes that information is lost. In which case, then, even if you say, give me a new password or tell me what my password is, it won't work, and then I'll reset your password for you manually. I'll tell you what it is, then you log in and change your password. Where you change your password is right here in personal information, right? And that's really easy for me to do, maybe about 30 or 45 seconds, right? So if you can't log in, make sure you talk to me so that you can. All right, so then you see your classes over here in the right-hand frame, and you're probably not taking quite as many classes as I am, but here's a physiology class. This is for one section. There are actually three different classes in here. So when you email me, please tell me the CRN of the class that you're in, because you saw that list of classes, I won't be able to find you in there unless I know the CRN, because, all of these things, All of these things are listed by CRN, not day and time or any other criteria. So I got to know your CRN to help you out. So if you want to memorize your CRN, that's fine. Or if you always want to look it up, that's fine too. Or just put it in your cell phone or something like that. All right, so we got syllabus, some course information. I forget what's in course information. Is there something helpful right here? Syllabus, the weekly study plan, welcome letter. Probably you're way past that already. But here are some plugins that you might want to take advantage of during the semester. You've already had to open up PDF files. But there will be some video files that you will want to look at during the semester, and you'll need a video player to do that, a plugin. And probably the most advanced I don't have in here, but I will put in here, is called VLC. DVX is fairly advanced. It's fairly new. It's very powerful. It doesn't add a bunch of spam into your computer. And I found that the VLC and DVX player always plays videos. I was smart enough to know all different kinds of formats. Sometimes Windows Media Player hangs up with Media Player. Sometimes you get the video, but you don't get the audio. Sometimes you get the audio, but not the video, and then it's a hassle to figure that out. But if you really love Windows Media Player, just go and update it. You might be running version 6, and I don't know what version they're on now. But it's maybe 13 or 14 or something like that. So just update it, and then it just might work. You also have to be able to view and print out PowerPoint slides, because I do lecture in this class from PowerPoints to some degree. All right, so plugins are pretty important. If you want to test your internet connection, here are a couple sites where you can test your internet connection. Just make sure you only click on Begin Test, because this is a free site. If you click on the wrong link, then it's going to try to sell you something or put something on your computer, right? So make sure you just click Begin Test, but it's a handy way to check your internet connection. So that's good for course information. Pre-lecture reading assignments. I do like to have people work with the material before lecture. I think maybe I emailed this out to you. All right, so if you click under here, all right, so here are a whole bunch of pre-lecture reading assignments. Chapter 1, Chapter 2, I got 2 on Chapter 2, Chapter 3, Chapter 6. Try to finish this material up before lecture, and you'll learn some new vocabulary, some new ways of thinking in a little bit, right? You won't learn completely what you need to learn for that chapter, but at least something to think about so that when I talk about it in lecture, it won't go completely over your head. I know the first time I hear something, it kind of goes right over my head, maybe rattles around a little bit. Second time I hear something, it makes a little bit more sense, right? Third time, starts to make sense. Fourth or fifth time, I have a pretty good idea what's going on, right? So become a little bit familiar with the material before you come to class, especially if you don't have a chemistry background, right? Work these pre-lecture chemistry pre-lecture reading assignments, and you don't get course points because what is missing? What's missing from this folder right here? No dollar signs, right? So this is just for your education. I'm happy to grade them, but you can grade them for yourselves because here are the answer keys. And the answer keys will become available to you after the lecture. All right, so the one for today, 26, became available at 12 p.m. The one for the 28th lecture will be on the 28th at 12 p.m. So go back in after lecture and just make sure that you're tracking along the same lines that I'm thinking. All right, so you might put a correct answer down in that pre-lecture reading assignment, but it might be just a little off compared to what I have in the key. So you should be aware of that because I write the exams in here. So you probably want to think exactly how I'm thinking. All right. Okay, weekly assignments. Study guides. These are some study guides. If you didn't buy the package, lecture recordings, like I said, I'm recording, and this will take you to another website. It's not in Blackboard, and you'll be able to download these lectures. Supplemental instruction. Your SI leader is going to be in here. That's from last semester. That's really close. At least the email address, name is the same. The location and time is to be determined yet for that. So a lot of handy resources. Lecture slides, you can print out material before lecture. Okay, and these are PowerPoint slides. What else do we have? Some free tutoring. My grades, this is where you're going to go and find grades. All right. Last important point here, weekly assignments. All right, I just put a little welcome note right there. Here's an extra credit syllabus quiz, and you know this is for course points because you see dollar sign, and here I tell you it's extra credit. Extra credit you do not have to do. All right, you can still get 100% in this class even if you don't do a single extra credit. But here's one anyway to help your grade. Just make sure that you have a copy of the syllabus around so that you can understand what those questions are. All right, so here's week one, week two, week three, week four. I have the first 3 weeks available right now, which I guess it's going to take us through a couple weeks, through week three. That will take us up to the first test. So you can get those quizzes out of the way. Week three has two chapters on it, chapter three and chapter six. So you see that there are some things for course points within these chapters. What kinds of things do we find? And so in these weekly assignments, well, here is an outline, objectives of what you should be learning for this particular week. All right, we have some animation quizzes where you can watch an animation, answer some questions after the animation to make sure that some of these concepts you become familiar with. Practice quizzes. Here are some links for practice quizzes. Hundreds of questions of practice quizzes. So you should be able to get a really good understanding of how you'll perform on a lecture exam because you can test yourself. And a lot of times I will take a question from these practice quizzes and put it on a lecture exam. So not all of the questions in a particular area I like, okay, and I will list for you what questions I do like. So not every single one. Some of the questions don't really relate to this class, and I delete that from this list right here. So plan your schedule. Make sure that you can answer these questions. I think on the study guide, I also tell you what questions I like at the end of the chapter that you should be familiar with. And some of those questions I could put on the lecture exam. So how do you use this as a good study technique? Well, go to this simple quiz right here. Take it. Maybe time yourself. This first time through might take you an hour to go through there, to look up information you don't know. Second time, it might take you 20 minutes. Third time, it might take you 10 minutes. And then the next time, it might take you 5 minutes. When you can complete these questions in 5 minutes, then that's a good place where you'll have fun on the test, right? Okay. And there's so many questions here, you can't memorize them. You have to understand what's going on, right? Unless you have photographic memory, then probably you only need to go through it one time. But otherwise, you need to work with this material. It's like a language. You have to use it in order for you to understand what's going on. And then here's that quiz. Chapter 1 quiz, you could take it today and tomorrow and the day after until the deadline. This is a short week, okay, and because it's a short week, you don't have a deadline this Thursday. When is the deadline for Chapter 1? Let's go back to the introductory page. Chapter 1 right here, August 25th through the 28th. This date is fine, but the deadline is September 4th. That's Thursday of next week. And that's going to be the deadline for the syllabus quiz, I believe. But that's also going to be the deadline for week number two. So I give you a little bit extra time for chapter one. And piggybacked on top of that is going to be chapter two. Next week on Thursday at 11 p.m. Those two quizzes have to be done. Yeah.
I clicked on those lists that you showed earlier.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I think I know what you mean.
Yeah,
the extra credit, no, not the extra credit, but the practice quiz,
yeah,
like right here.
They don't go there.
Okay. Let's click on this thing right here and see what kind of problem I run into and show you how I get over it. Or maybe I can't get through it. Maybe something has changed. Sometimes it's problematic, so I do give you the actual link that you can copy and paste into your browser. Right? But you shouldn't have to do that every time. This set of questions is in one edition of your textbook, the 11th edition, right? These questions here are in a different textbook, the 10th edition. So when you log into this over here, the computer knows that you're in the 11th edition, and when you click over here, it says, well, I can't go there because you're in the 11th edition. But if you go back and click it one more time, then it will understand you really want to go to the 10th edition. So sometimes it just requires reiterating your request. All right, so let's click on that, and it says, not found. Okay. And if we go here, it says, probably right here, let me close that, probably says not found once again. Okay. Okay, okay. All right. What happens if we do something like this? All right, so let's... Okay, it's keeping you in Blackboard, but it's not found. Okay, that's too bad. The last thing I can try is this. But I got a feeling it's going to say not found. Okay, that's a problem because those are really good resources. What about these down over here? It's just not finding these. Okay, I'm going to have to update those. Hopefully they haven't disappeared, but usually things don't disappear completely from the internet. Okay. But nonetheless, what I said, sometimes if you work in one edition and then go to the next, it's going to say, oh, wrong edition, but just do it again. Yeah. Wow. Okay, maybe see me after class and I'll take a note on that. And then I'll reprogram these things. Okay. Okay, so yeah, thanks for mentioning that. Because I do take exam questions from these banks of questions right here. All right, so that's pretty much Blackboard. Anybody have another question about Blackboard at all? Pretty good. Just make sure you can log in this week. Otherwise, you'll get just too far behind. Yeah.
I was going to say that the positive and negative feedback things are also bad.
Positive in week number one? Right here?
Yeah.
And tell me what you know about that?
If you click on it, it doesn't leave anything.
Same thing? That's in one of these editions down here. So I could see where that would not work. Okay. I've got to fix that, because those are nice resources for you. Okay. Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. So if you run into something like that, email me right away, and I can take a look. Okay. I do have the lectures pretty much ready to go. All right, so we're going to start with chapter one right here. If you want to bring out your notes. If you want to just keep these in your computer and not print them out, that's fine with me. Pretty much all of these materials, you probably want to download them to your hard drive. That way, if you don't have internet connection for some reason, you still have the material in your computer. Right? So, and the way that you download something, maybe I could go back. How would you download something to your computer? Say you're in Blackboard. Okay, say you're in Blackboard and you want to download a syllabus. The best way of doing that, okay, is just hover over the link and then right-click. I don't know if all you Macintosh people know what I'm talking about, but the mouse usually has two buttons. You usually click on the left-hand one, but if you right-click, right, you get a bunch of options. Right, you can open or you can save it. Go ahead and save it, download it, that way you'll always have it on your computer. Right, you don't always have to go back to the internet to get it. Okay. If you put it in your computer and if you're the kind of person that learns by looking at a computer, then that's fine with me. You don't have to print them out. But if you are the kind of person that you need to write on something and actually have a physical book in front of you, then I would go ahead and print them out. If you get a viewer, I think you can only print them out one page at a time. But if you actually get the PDF program or the Microsoft PowerPoint program, then you could print two to a page or four to a page or whatever. Four is a little bit small. You won't be able to read what's going on. But you'll save a lot of paper that way. With the reader, I don't think you can take it out of color mode. But if you have PowerPoint program, you can say grayscale. So there are a little bit of differences. Yeah. I'd be the kind of person that probably would print them out. and also keep them on my hard drive. Okay, where are we here? Here we are. All right, so this is almost the first slide that I show in anatomy, but not quite. I don't see anatomy on here. But let's start with anatomy. What is anatomy? It's a scientific study of structure, yeah. And since we're looking at the human body, it's the structure of the human body. And so we know that on a hand, you have 5 digits, right? And you know your thumb. How would you describe where your thumb is compared to your other digits? It is lateral, right? Because you got to go into anatomic position, right? Your little finger is medial. All right, so that's just anatomy. It's just knowing where things are and what the relationship of different structures are to each other. All right, but it doesn't really tell you what these digits do. Right? But there nonetheless is a relationship between the structure of your body and how it works. And how it works is physiology, right? Which is why we are here. So you know anatomy because you can't really understand physiology unless you appreciate anatomy first. And as a matter of fact, it's anatomy that determines what the function of something is. If you change the structure of something, then you're going to change also the function of something. So if you're function of your body changes, then you can infer going back the other way, if the functioning of your body changes, what can you think of? Then some structure inside your body has changed as well. And it could be a gross anatomical feature like a bone, or it could be something like a molecular structure, maybe a receptor or something like that. All right. So physiology is the study of how the body works to maintain life. And what determines that is the structure. A really nice example that I use is, here's my hand. Of course, I've got 5 digits, but digit number 1 is really special because it's an opposable thumb, right? And so that allows me to grab things like a pencil, fork, things like that. I'm happy about that. And if you see my hand, I'm really proud to show you both hands. I've got 5 fingers still. That's really nice because I grew up in a machine shop. And I could have lost the finger pretty easily. But let's just say I did. Let's just say I did lose this thumb right here. What did I change when I take this thumb away? I changed the structure, but what else changed? The function also changed, right? So now I can't grab things quite as well. So there is that relationship between structure and function, and structure determines what the physiology is. And so pathophysiology is just the study of physiological processes that are altered from normal. And we're going to look at some pathophysiology in this class, too, and physiology. So we're going to use a lot of anatomy to understand. I got to get my cursor working here. Ah, there. Okay. Anybody have a question on the comparison, the contrast with physiology and anatomy, what the differences and why they are important? Okay. So think about that a little bit. Maybe ask me after class or next week. All right, scientific method. I want to say just a couple things about scientific method. It's a pretty long process, right? And it requires experimentation, requires some other things. So let's look at some of the things that scientific method requires, right? In order to come up with a theory, right, we have to first formulate a testable hypothesis about something that you've observed in your environment. So a hypothesis is just a guess. It's just an unproven guess. It's maybe an educated guess because you've seen something happen over and over and over again, right? But you haven't applied any experiments. You haven't analyzed data, right? So it really hasn't become a theory. It is just a hypothesis. I know a lot of times when we're walking down the street talking with friends and talking about a particular topic, and you might have some pretty important insights that you want to share with everybody, and you stop everybody and say, oh, but I have a theory about this particular aspect of what we're talking about. All right, but what does that person really mean? Because they really haven't submitted it to scientific method, they haven't done experiments, they haven't analyzed things by using statistics, but they have a hypothesis, which is an educated guess. But that's what the scientific method starts with. You have to have an idea of trying to find some valuable information, and that's what a hypothesis is. But not everybody knows that. Plus, it's just way too complicated to say hypothesis all the time as opposed to theory, right? But when somebody says they have a theory, make sure that you understand that it really is probably just a hypothesis. It's just a guess. All right, so you come up with that guess, and then you come up with experiments to test whether that hypothesis is true. And you have to conduct those experiments in a special way and then analyze the results of the experiment, preferably with the use of statistics, because statistics is unbiased, right? It's just a mathematical method, and who's ever applying the statistics can't influence what the results of the statistics are, because it's an unbiased way of doing that. Then after you analyze results of an experiment, you can draw conclusions about whether the results will support the hypothesis that you have proposed. And if you do that experiment over and over and over again, and you tell other people about your experiment so that they can repeat it, right, all over the world, then it can become a theory. Right, so a theory is just a general statement explaining something about the natural environment based on a proven hypothesis, something that's proved by experiments. So scientific method is kind of long and drawn out. It's expensive, right? So why do we put up with scientific method, right, to come up with a theory? What's the most important thing? What's the most important concept? I mean, you're going to spend a lot of money, you're going to spend a lot of time, it's kind of tedious. Got to know statistics. Okay, why put up with all of that? Because you can reproduce. Yeah, you can reproduce these effects over and over and over again. So that means that the information that you get is reliable. It's something that you can count on. All right. So the purpose of the scientific method. Certainly, you want to jot this down. The purpose is that it provides you, gives you reliable information. Okay, so reliable information is the big deal right there. And that's what you want. Okay, maybe you didn't know when or where this class was. You talked to a friend, and the friend gave you a wrong time, and you missed the class. Well, that's not reliable information, right? So you always want to live with good, reliable information. Scientific method will give that to you. So when you look at the textbook, all of the material in your textbook is at the level of theory. Right? Lots of people have looked and run experiments on all this information. You're going to read some stuff in here and you're going to say, well, that can't possibly be true. It's just too wild, too weird. But you know what? It is theory. If I bring some interesting points into class that is not theory, but it's just a hypothesis, I'll tell you that this is just my guess of what is happening. And it'll probably be a pretty good guess, but it's still not at the level of theory. But all that money you spent to buy that textbook is good because it's giving you what? Your textbook is giving you, because it is theory, it's giving you reliable information, right? Okay. All right, so how do you test a hypothesis, right? Well, for instance, if we're interested in finding out the efficacy or the usefulness of a particular drug, for instance, we want to have a patient population and separate them into two groups. We want the population to be just one uniform group, but we want to split them into two groups. And there's going to be an experimental group and then a control group. The experimental group will get the drug that we're trying to test. Right? Maybe it's a drug that will decrease somebody's temperature. So we give this drug to people, and how would we tell if it decreases their temperature? We would, yeah, measure it with a thermometer. I suppose you could touch their skin and see what happens, and that's a measurement, but not as good as using a nicely calibrated thermometer that you know is accurate and precise. Right? And then the control group over here will receive everything except that particular drug. So if the drug, for instance, has to be dissolved in an oil substance, right, and administered with a shot, this control group can't get a pill. These control group people have to get a shot, and they also have to get a shot that contains the oil, but not the active ingredient that you're testing for, because sometimes oil even has certain properties. Certainly it has estrogenic properties, any kind of oil. Right, so that is how you would think about an experimental group and control group. And here, these quantitative measures, like for instance measuring temperature, should be performed blindly. Right, so somebody's going to be administering a shot to these different people, whether they're in the control group or in the experimental group, and who's ever administering the shot should really know nothing about the study. They shouldn't know what person is in which group. Because whenever you give a shot to somebody, right? You pass on information, facial expression, how you say things, which might influence the outcome of the study. So when we say blind, means that who's ever doing the experiments, right, should not know what they're doing. Right? They should just follow a protocol so that they can't influence what the outcome is. And then after you measure all that temperature data, you measure, right, then you apply statistics to all those different measurements. So quantitative means you come up with a number, not just say hot, cold, or real hot, or real cold, freezing. You come up with a number, right, in maybe a Fahrenheit scale or a centigrade scale, and then you can apply that data, those numbers, to statistics to find out if these two groups really are significantly different from each other. All right, so you're beginning to see it's a little bit complicated to do apply scientific method. All right, so what is the purpose of scientific method once again? Yeah, it provides reliable information. There's going to be an election coming up, and you'll hear a lot of things on the news saying, well, we've done this poll, and this person is leading this other person in vote count, and it was a scientific study, okay? But was it really science? The answer is no, because there was no control group, right? They just called people. And they have some kind of model, but it's not really science. And people that were making the calls maybe knew what they were trying to find out. So it's really not scientific method. Right? It's just some polling methods. Okay. All right, homeostasis. Here's the first concept in this class. Kind of a big word. And homeostasis is the condition inside the human body. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me switch this over. I don't want everybody to wreck their necks. I can do this. Sorry. Okay. It's a condition inside the body where there are various parameters like blood pressure, the amount of acidity. The amount of acidity can be measured, and we come up with a number that we call the pH. So it is a quantitative measurement of acidity or alkalinity inside somebody's body. Right. Temperature is another parameter that we can measure. Fluid concentrations we can measure. We'll talk about how you measure some of these things. And all kinds of other factors. So we've got temperature, blood pressure. These probably some of the more obvious ones. Of your body or the internal environment are maintained within a range suitable to support life. All right, so let's just think of body temperature, for instance. And your body temperature can't vary too much, right? You can become hypothermic when it drops, and that can lead to death. You can become hyperthermic, and that will lead to death as well. And does anybody know what the normal body temperature is? 98 something, 98.6, centigrade, I don't know exactly what it is. Did you say in centigrade what it was?
No.
No, okay. But that's what it is. All right, and if it varies too much, then you're in a disease state. All right, but is your body temperature absolutely constant all day long, every day of the week? And you're shaking your head no, and that's fantastic, okay? Homeostasis means not that temperature has to stay absolutely constant. It can vary, but not vary so much that it puts you in a disease state, right? So it's not constant, and that's what this term homeostasis means, that things stay the same while everything is changing. All right, so your body temperature, how do you know that your body temperature increases sometimes, even if you don't have a thermometer? Yeah, you start sweating. That's right, because you won't sweat unless your body temperature is above normal. So that's some proof that your body temperature is not exactly the same. All right, so you had all that water inside your body. Right, before you started sweating, your body temperature went up, and you start sweating. Now what happens to the water balance inside your body? Yeah, it drops, right? So the water balance inside your body is doing what? It's changing all day long as well, right? But all of these things work together so that nothing has to change by a large degree that will produce a disease state. So when I think of homeostasis, I really see a dance going on right here. I see that blood pressure is dancing around. It's going up and going down a little bit. The pH is going high, going low a little bit. Temperature up and down. But these things are changing to compensate for changes in other things inside your body. And these changes are very, very small so that you stay within a normal range of values. All right, so homeostasis is a dynamic state where all the body's systems are working and constantly adjusting, right? So things are changing all the time. They're adjusting to the changing internal as well as external conditions, right? So if we were in Phoenix and we walked outside and it's 113 degrees, right, that's an external condition. For sure you're going to start sweating to cool your internal environment down. And how would you compensate for losing all that water by sweating if we lived in Phoenix and had to go walk to our car in 113 degrees? Yeah, you would get a sensation of thirst, right? And then you would drink some water. There's some other things that would happen, which we'll look at. Your kidneys would be given a signal to conserve water, and that would produce less urine, or urine that's very concentrated in salt, so that our body would retain as much water as possible. Okay. So we're going to look at that when we get to the endocrine system and the renal system. All right, so that's kind of a complicated term right there, homeostasis, but just think of it as a dance of all these different parameters, always changing, but not so much that it produces a disease state. So how do different parts of your body communicate with each other? Because they need to change to compensate for other changes. Well, that happens through what we call reflexes. These are, a reflex is something you don't have to think about. It just automatically happens. So sometimes, right there, well, one class is hormone secreting reflex system. So here is a cell and it secretes a hormone, right? And that hormone diffuses into the blood. And then once it's in the blood, it goes everywhere in the body, but it can only affect the tissue that's a target tissue. Right, and a target tissue or target cell has to have a receptor for this particular hormone. All right, so this system right here, we see this hormone secreting cell. Can you remember from anatomy what kind of cell or what kind of gland this is if it secretes a hormone? That is an endocrine gland. Yeah, it's an endocrine gland, right? So an endocrine gland is a gland that secretes a hormone into the blood where it travels to a distant location and it produces a specific physiological response in that target tissue. And in this class, the other thing that you have to know is that a target tissue has to have a receptor to that hormone, otherwise it won't even know it's there. Okay? And a hormone will bind to a receptor based on the anatomy of that molecule, the shape of the receptor and the shape of the signaling molecule. Okay? And if the shape of that hormone changes, guess what? Then it won't bind to that receptor, and there'll be some pathology in that system right there. All right, so this is a hormone-secreting cell. A nerve cell will secrete chemicals, and it will diffuse to a neighboring cell to change the physiology of a neighboring nerve cell. So it's not a long-distance reflex. That chemical that a neuron secretes is what we call a neuro, because it's a neuron transmitter. It's transmitting information. It's transmitting a signal from one cell to another. All right, so chemical signals from a nerve are what we call a neurotransmitter. Let's look at this last system over here. Here we have a nerve cell, and it secretes a signaling molecule outside the cell, and it gets picked up by the blood, and it goes to a distant location, and it signals this target cell right here to change its physiology. So number one, what does this target cell have to have in order to respond to this signaling molecule? Got to have a receptor, right, that matches up. All right, but now this is a little confusing, because what did we learn? What's the name of that compound, the signaling compound that is secreted by a neuron? We learned it's a neurotransmitter. But what about over here? What's the name of a compound that gets picked up by the blood and transmitted everywhere in the body? That's a hormone. Okay, so we got neurotransmitter and hormone. So the big question here is, well, what the heck is this thing? Is it a neurotransmitter or is it a hormone? It's a hybrid, exactly right. Right? So in a lot of classes, so it's a neurohormone, it's a hybrid, it's a neurohormone. In a lot of classes, we don't study the nervous system by itself, we don't study the endocrine system by itself, because there are a number of places where they're really one system, they're integrated together. And I'll be sure to point that out in this class. And maybe when I teach anatomy, I do. I don't know if you can remember any of these places, special places where there are neurohormones being used. Anybody remember from anatomy where a neurohormone might be used? Not just a neurotransmitter, not just a hormone. But there are some compounds from the posterior pituitary, which are secreted by neurons from the hypothalamus into the blood, like antidiuretic hormone and oxytocin. Those would be examples of neurohormones. Right, and we got some other examples. So they're interesting. They're kind of almost unique, not unique, but they're interesting, so I'll be sure to point those out in this class. Another way, instead of these longer reflexes, we got short range, local control. So for instance, here we have a cell, and it will release a signaling compound into the space around the cell. Does anybody remember what the space around the cell is called? Extracellular space, interstitial space, right, something like that. Okay, so not into the blood, just into the fluid that surrounds all of these cells, and it will move by diffusion to a cell that's not right next to it, but it's in the neighborhood. At least it will get there by diffusion, and we say that this is a target cell, so what does this target cell have to have? It's got to have a receptor, right? Okay. It's a short-range reflex. Here's even a shorter-range reflex. Here is a cell, and it's experiencing some kind of change in the environment, or maybe it's receiving a signal from another cell. So it secretes a signaling agent, right, and it goes into the interstitial space, but then it changes the physiology inside of the cell that secreted it. But this agent has to be outside, can't be inside the cell. So that tells me, well, let's analyze that a little bit. What does the cell that's secreting this autocrine agent, what does it have to have in order to sense it? It's got to have a receptor. Okay, it's got to have a receptor. Otherwise, it's going to be completely blind to it. And where is that receptor? I said, if this autocrine agent is inside the cell, it won't change the physiology. But if it's outside the cell, that's when the physiology will change. So the receptor is on the cell membrane facing the outside. There are no receptors inside the cell for this particular compound. So we're going to look at a number of signaling agents where sometimes the receptor is on the outside of the cell, sometimes it's on the inside of the cell, and you'll know some really nifty physical chemistry to predict which way it's going to be. All right? And their actions are going to be interesting to look at because they're different. Okay, so just remember, in order for some kind of signaling compound to affect the physiology of a cell, there's got to be a receptor involved with it. All right, here is some more things about homeostasis. All right. Sometimes people think of homeostasis as dynamic constancy. Well, what does that mean? I don't know, it sounds like a lot of gobbledygook. It just means that things are changing, but not very much. Things are changing all the time, but only in little bits. Okay, that's what homeostasis and dynamic constancy, some people use that term. All right, so homeostasis conditions are stabilized above or below a physiological set point. That set point is what we call the normal value for a particular parameter. And the way that homeostasis is maintained is by something that we call a feedback loop, and in particular, a negative feedback loop. And you're going to be working with that in lab. As a matter of fact, that's going to be the drawing, the extra credit drawing at the end of lab for today and on Thursday for you to do, is to just block this out. So I sent you a flow diagram or a concept map of a feedback loop, and in particular, a negative feedback loop. So that will help you remember what a negative feedback loop is in a graphic form. Because again, you guys are just stepping out of anatomy. That's probably the best way right now that you learn new things, is by looking at pictures and drawing, right, these concept maps out. All right, so here we have some kind of parameter. We could say that this is blood pressure. We could say that this is temperature. We could say this is electrolyte concentration inside your body, like sodium or potassium. And what can you tell me about this particular parameter? Let's just say that this is blood pressure, right? Is it absolutely constant? Is your blood pressure absolutely constant if this is your blood pressure that we measured? Sometimes it's low, sometimes it's high. Okay, it's changing all the time. But does it change drastically? When it starts to go up, what do you see? It starts to go back down. Okay. When you see a parameter changing, it could be either going negative or it could be going positive like that, but if it always goes back down to what the normal value is, then we know that there's a nice negative feedback mechanism that's taking place. So a negative feedback mechanism forces this parameter to go back down to normal or go back up to normal. If it was a positive feedback mechanism, and this is temperature, okay, as soon as your temperature increased, if it was positive feedback, what would happen to your temperature? It would continue to get hotter, right? And if that positive feedback mechanism was still operating, right, what would happen to your body temperature? It would go higher, right? And then higher and higher and higher and higher, and then you would just explode in a ball of flames, right? So that would be death. Probably not that drastic, but nonetheless, you would die of hyperthermia. All right, so positive feedback mechanisms usually produce a disease state. A negative feedback mechanism produces a normal, healthy state because it forces this parameter back to this normal value, this normal absolute value. If we measure every point right here, add them together, right, and take the average of them, we see it right here. That's what we call the set point. The set point is just one number. Right? But you don't always have to be at set point. You just can't get too far away from it to maintain a healthy range. All right. So if you see something going back to the normal or to the set point every time, then you know that's a negative feedback mechanism. Here's a pretty good diagram. Not as good as the one you're going to draw in lab, but pretty good. X right here is, we could say it's temperature. We could say it's blood pressure, but some kind of parameter that's inside your body. And what can you tell me about X? Is it absolutely constant, or is it going to be changing all day long? Even if you look at the whole slide, you'll see the answer on the slide. But you pretty much know already, well, there's nothing that's absolutely constant in your body. And that's a good thing. It's a fantastic thing. Because what if there was something absolutely constant in your body, like temperature? What could you tell me about you? You'd be dead, right? If your temperature is not changing, you're at room temperature, not changing, then that's certainly not a healthy state. All right, so this parameter is changing all the time. If you look at the slide, here it is, right? And sometimes it increases, sometimes it decreases. Whatever that, you could say X is temperature, blood pressure, or whatever. Okay, so here is some parameter that's changing. And let's just say it starts to increase. How does your body know that temperature or blood pressure is increasing? Just like all those cells that we look at, how does it know that it's being signaled by a hormone chemical? It has to have a receptor. And in this particular case, we could say receptor or we could say sensor. In order for your body to appreciate this parameter right here, it has to have a sensor, right? If something happened to your eyes and you lost your eyes, will you be able to sense light? Nope, you need those receptors, right? Okay, so you need a special sensor for this particular parameter. The sensor then sends the information, usually via a neuron, and usually it's going to be the central nervous system. We're going to call this the integration center. And the integration center knows what the absolute normal value is, the set point. That information then is compared to the set point, and if the sensor is sending information to the integration center that exactly matches up the set point, right, what does your body have to do to remain normal? If the sensor is measuring something that's normal, integration center says, well, everything's normal, there's nothing that we have to do. But if there's a big difference between, right, the set point and this parameter right here, then the integration center has to make a decision on what to do so that it goes back down to the normal value. So integration center makes some deciding. It's got a set point, number one, makes a decision, and then it sends this decision out from the central nervous system to the periphery to an effector, which then changes the direction of this parameter. If your temperature here is increasing, then here is going to decrease the temperature. And because these arrows, if we were to add these arrows together, would they add or subtract from each other? They would cancel each other out. They would subtract, right? And because they subtract from each other, that's why we call this a negative feedback mechanism, because they subtract. If they add together, right, if this parameter keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, that's what we call positive feedback mechanism. So on you, which mechanism is better, positive or negative? Even negative? You sure it has this like negative connotation to it? And the answer is yeah, because this thing right here, the stimulus, right, and the response, they're going to subtract from each other to produce a normal value. All right, so integration center's got that set point. Effector produces a response. So let's think of temperature. What would be an effector if you become hypothermic, if your body temperature starts to decrease? So you have some thermosensors in your brain that's telling your body, oh, you're becoming too cold. Right, we need to warm your body up. It sends this information out via, oh, what kind of nerve is leaving the central nervous system to the periphery? What kind of nerve do we call that? That's an efferent or motor neuron, right? And as opposed to this neuron right here, what would be this neuron here? That would be afferent or afferent, if you want to say. Usually I say afferent and efferent. I mispronounce it a little bit, but so I don't mispronounce and you can understand what I'm saying. And another name for afferent is sensory, right? So here's sensory, here's motor. Sensory brings information into the CNS, motor takes it away. And in particular, now you could tell me what this effector is. What is this effector that's going to increase your body temperature? Has anybody ever been so cold that you started to shiver and shake? Yeah. So this effector here would be skeletal muscle. Right, and that would increase your body temperature, that would subtract from the stimulus, which was a decrease in temperature, that would be good negative feedback. And we see that on the diagram here. All right, so at this location, we see that, for instance, temperature increases, so yeah, temperature is increasing right here, but we don't want to become hyperthermic. The integration center is going to know that your body temperature is increasing because it has these sensory nerves and it has this sensor. It compares that to a set point and says, oh, your body temperature is way too high, way too low, we got to change that. All right, we're going to stimulate these muscles to contract. And it doesn't correspond to this diagram here. Okay, it's the other way around. This one right here is what? Your body temperature gets too hot. Let's think about that. All right, so your body temperature is increasing. The sensor tells the integration center your temperature is too high. Now, what is the integration center going to do? What decision is it going to make? It's not going to tell skeletal muscles to contract. It's going to tell sweat glands to secrete sweat. So in this particular case, the effector organ would be a sweat gland. And when we sweat, we have that water on the surface of our body, and when it evaporates, right, it requires a lot of energy to do that, and that will cool our body down. All right, and that's what we see over here. When the effector, that sweat gland, is activated, then your body temperature decreases. But you shouldn't freeze to death, right? Because when you get cooled down, then the integration center is going to know you're getting too cold, and it will tell skeletal muscles to contract. All right, so you see that temperature is not absolutely constant. It is changing all the time. Now, how do you know when you look at this graph right here, this drawing, that it is a negative feedback mechanism and not a positive feedback mechanism taking place? Because it goes away from this set point, but it always returns to it, right? So if it starts to go up, it goes down. If it was positive feedback, if it goes up, it would continue to go up. So it's really, you can diagnose these things very easily. Casual inspection, you can tell if it's positive or negative feedback loop. This is the drawing that you have in lab today, exactly like this. All right, so here's the stimulus. That's in the previous example, that would be the up arrow. That's a stimulus, right? In order for your body to appreciate a stimulus, it's got to have a sensor or a receptor. And here's the integration center. Let's say it's in the brain or spinal cord. How does this information from a sensor get into the central nervous system via afferent nerve, afferent pathway? Right, integration center will analyze that and make a decision. So what is in this integration center so that it can analyze this information? It's got the set point, right? The absolute normal value of what it should be. Makes a decision, sends that information to an effector via an efferent pathway, and an effector produces a response, right? So you could think of this as a reflex or a response loop. What does a response loop always start with? Stimulus. And what does response loop always end with? Response. What produces a response? Effector, right? And what understands a stimulus? Yeah, sensor or receptor. Yeah. So here's a nice graphical way to try to appreciate some of those things. Oh, here's that slide right there. All right, so we're almost done. Next time we'll finish up this chapter, move into the next chapter. Okay, but homeostasis is something that we're going to think about every single day in here for the whole semester.